Good morning and welcome to Rich Answers, a public affairs program brought to you by Light 100.5 WRCH and the Conference of Churches. I'm Reverend Dr. Shelley Best, and I'd like to welcome you to an hour of conversation and inspiration with transformational leaders in and about Greater Hartford. Today we are fortunate once again to have Dr. Miriam Jernigan Noesi, who is the President and CEO of Jernigan & Associates, a psychological and educational consulting firm. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We were fortunate the last time to have a conversation with you about your practice, and I wanted to follow up with a conversation on a recent article that you produced titled, Hashtag Racial Trauma is Real. And it was written for the Institution for the Study and Promotion of Race and Culture. Clearly, we're at a time now in the United States where there's so much that has been stirred up from the conversations that people had a couple of years ago on the death of Trayvon Martin, looking at Ferguson, looking at Baltimore, looking at other crises that have happened around our country. And from the standpoint of a psychologist, I'd like to know a little bit more about how you got into writing this article and what we're seeing from a mental health standpoint among people of the African-American community when it comes to all of these cases.
So the article is actually written with individuals that I met and many of whom I trained with at Boston College. So the Institute for the Study and Promotion of Race and Culture was started by Dr. Janet E. Helms there, who's also a psychologist. With the idea of integrating and understanding the importance of race and culture. And so for many of us who are licensed psychologists providing direct service care, engaged in research or advocacy, we had been having this conversation behind the scenes. And so one of the conversations we were having via email was about the fact that as professionals, given everything that's been going on nationally, it was becoming increasingly sort of challenging for us as healers and helping professionals to be able to collect ourselves and sort of go into work and sort of continue on through our days. So the hashtag racial trauma is real, you know, really sort of came as a result of a conversation of saying, listen, racial trauma is real. This is a very real experience for many people. And we know this because this is the work we've been writing about and engaged in for many years. But seeing sort of news clips, reading things, inundating our, you know, sort of ourselves with social media, you know, we ourselves were also reporting insomnia, et cetera. So we thought, you know, what better way than to, you know, offer something to the larger community than to really deliberately, as opposed to our traditional publishing and peer reviewed journals and academic journals, to produce a body of work that addressed for people of color what we saw going on for ourselves, but also for those we were working with, in an effort to really sort of assist with identifying, but also healing and understanding the impact of what it means to experience trauma intergenerationally around race and racism, but also vicariously given everything that's been going on as of late.
And what would you define as racial trauma?
So racial trauma is a term that, at least for the field of psychology, it's been written about and formally sort of written about as race-based trauma. So just to provide a little bit of background, you know, one of the documents that mental health professionals often use is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And in, you know, the DSM, as we call it, we're now in our fifth iteration of the DSM, there's certainly attention to issues related to trauma, most often spoken about as post-traumatic stress. For years in the field of psychology, I think multicultural scholars in particular have attempted to advocate for the field of mental health to understand the impact from a mental health perspective of racism and discrimination. And so the groundwork had really been laid, you know, by some of my mentors and persons who trained and practiced before myself, to advocate for within the field as well as legally this idea that experiencing racism and discrimination has a negative effect on our mental health, but the continued experience over time, you know, has an even more complicated effect. And that continued experience may result from, you know, stories that you've heard, you know, from your grandmothers or other generations. But also that can be exacerbated by when racial tensions are high, as they have been really for the last couple of years, due to the national attention to some of the killings that have happened and the due to sort of police interactions and other cases like Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, and those more recently.
And how does it show up in an individual? You talked about the possibility of, for example, insomnia. How does racial trauma show up in an individual?
I think the most important piece is, and what we recommend in the article, is it shows up, I think, in individuals differently. And it shows up, I would say, kind of in the body. So it really becomes important to become mindful and aware of, based on your own individual experience, what you are experiencing. So some of persons that I've worked with clinically, as well as my colleagues, will talk about, you know, it may start with, you know, the inability to fall asleep or stay asleep. When watching the news or reading news reports, sort of feeling their stomach tighten, feeling more irritable, feeling anxiety even, so anxious about going into work and perhaps meeting and sitting with colleagues. It may result in distractibility, the inability to focus. But the trauma piece also is, you know, sort of thinking about symptoms, like just sort of re-imaging or, you know, having flashbacks about triggers, about instances that may have occurred in your own life as you're watching and sort of seeing what's going on nationally in the news. So these, again, if you think about post-traumatic stress from a war perspective, we talk about things like flashbacks and insomnia and depression and sadness and anxiety. When we talk about, you know, abuse, those things as well. And it really is this push, which I think, you know, we are getting there in our latest iteration of the DSM, of also recognizing that racism and discrimination in particular also result in those similar experiences. So people will talk about having nightmares and dreams and not being able to focus and kind of thinking about an incident that may have happened over and over and over again and not being able to move on. And then that resulting in feelings of depression and crying sort of sporadically, anxiety, and more.
And when we think about what's going on nationally, for so many of us, I'm a person on social media, so because I have like-minded friends, everyone's posting various articles of what's going on in the country, another person dead, another person dead. Mm-hmm. But then I recognize that many of us experience microaggressions every day.
Yes.
So what's happening to us? And maybe for those who are listening, you can describe microaggressions as well, so people understand how people relate to that in addition to the other national traumas.
Sure. So microaggressions is a more, I think, not a recent term. It's actually coined by Chester Pierce, who's a Black psychiatrist from Harvard University. And he talked about, I believe in the 70s, this notion that, you know, as we sort of moved from at least from a political climate, which may have endorsed, you know, overt experiences of racism and discrimination, to legally that not being okay. What many people begin to describe are these covert experiences. So interpersonal interactions, for example, often example of a microaggression for many people of color will be statements like, you know, you are so articulate if you're a person of color. So the expectation is that a person of color cannot be articulate. In addition, it's, you know, interpersonal interactions where people attempt to sort of minimize the, you know, sort of efforts or contributions of people of color. So sitting in a work meeting, you know, might be another example where you may have contributed something, it's not acknowledged. One of your white colleagues then says the same thing, and then that is sort of recognized or acknowledged. For many women of color, they often talk about the fact that their intellectual contributions at work may not be recognized. In fact, people will attend to things like their hair or their clothing. So, you know, all of these have been written about in the field of psychology, and the term really kind of reemerged through more recent research to talk about these sort of microaggressions, these little slights that can happen on a day-to-day basis in one's, you know, personal life, but also certainly in school. So I also talk about microaggressions with children. So the fact that they're often seen and experience, their experiences that people assume that they're intellectually inferior, those types of occurrences. So it's, you know, thinking about the history of racism and oppression that really, you know, have been the experience for many communities of color, that in conjunction with those day-to-day experiences and sort of slights which people sort of take in, and they may have to in that meeting. You know, the idea is they have to make it through the meeting, and perhaps they're not reacting. But after the meeting, they're thinking about, you know, was this my experience? How come no one sort of intervened? But really those experiences coupled together over time, that cumulative effect of those can really have negative consequences from mental health perspective as well as physical health. We're also seeing emerging research, which is looking at, you know, what are the consequences when people report, you know, experience after experience of microaggressions or macroaggressions, so more overt experiences of discrimination.
So let's look at that a little bit more when we think about so many people saying, well, we're in a post-racial time. Mm-hmm. We have a black president. How can there be these issues? Maybe people just need to get over it. Slavery's been over for how many years now? Mm-hmm. Is there evidence that there is something more going on? And does it indeed scientifically show up in the bodies of African-American people?
Yes. I mean, I think there's a lot, thank goodness, of persons who have kind of pushed back on this notion of post-racial, who really have an understanding that racism is systemic. And so simply, you know, certainly one can say that we have a black president. At the same time, that does not mean that the sort of systemic effects of racism and slavery have disappeared. And arguably, there have even been articles written about sort of since Barack Obama was elected as president, that there are sort of increasing overt experiences of racism in certain geographic pockets of the country that people are experiencing. So racism is not dead by any means. And I think that recognition definitely needs to be there in terms of being able to identify this as an issue. So one of the conversations that I have with young people and with parents is about the importance of understanding history. It's a process in the field of psychology that we call racial socialization. So by way of example, you know, when my parents, for example, were growing up, because of segregation, there were explicit messages that in many ways the church community and families gave children of color about the important, you know, sort of pride and their abilities to sort of be confident in who they were as people of color, because that did not happen in other places like schools, etc. That conversation I found in working with young people and with families has in many ways kind of disappeared for, you know, multiple reasons. So when I talk to parents, they'll often say, well, I had such traumatic experiences that I did not want to, you know, sort of share those experiences with my children. Now that has resulted in young people really being confused about their experiences. So they've been told by society that we're post-racial, racism doesn't exist, and yet their direct experiences in the classroom and in other places contradict that. So when I'm working with, and I've worked with young people, what's interesting is I can say, do you think racism exists? They will tell me no. If I ask them to tell me about their day, there's a different sort of description that I would understand, you know, that they're having experiences of racism, discrimination. So it becomes part of my work to kind of engage in that racial socialization process, which unfortunately, I would say, in terms of how parents are talking to children, is really not as prominent as it used to be. And it's critical. So I always encourage parents to have explicit conversations to prepare their youth to be able to identify, but also be able to strategize around those experiences.
We're talking with Dr. Miriam Jernigan, and we'll be back after the break. You're listening to Rich Answers from the Conference of Churches on Light 100.5 WRCH. Be sure to like us on Facebook and tell us what inspires you. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Miriam Jernigan Noesi, who is the president and CEO of Jernigan & Associates. And we're talking about her article on Racial Trauma is Real. In the article, you talk about the importance of having conversations and helping people to better understand what's going on. And you have a number of tips in that article talking about the importance of acknowledging, first of all. Talk about that.
Sure. I mean, I think the big piece is, you know, sort of awareness about what's going on. I think that ties into the movement that we're seeing, you know, in terms of like Eastern medicine and thinking about just mindfulness and awareness. But from the perspective of thinking about the impact and potential effects of racial discrimination and racism, it really starts with for individuals as well as for groups, sort of recognizing that this is an issue, and being able to, as I said, it shows up differently for each person, but really being able to acknowledge what is happening and when is it happening. So am I watching too much TV, too many news segments? Am I reading, you know, my Facebook feed and reading more articles and becoming more upset? What am I noticing in my body as a result of this? Am I not eating? Am I not able to sleep? So really sort of paying attention to.
Or am I eating too much?
Yes. Am I eating too much, to, you know, an attempt to sort of soothe myself and my emotions? So how is this affecting me? I think is the first piece in an effort to be able to then figure out, you know, what might I need to do? How do I need to, you know, recalibrate, so to speak, to be able to address what it is that I am experiencing.
And then you say in the article, you know, there is an importance of having discussion around this. Mm-hmm. Who do you find to talk to about it?
I think the important piece, when we were, you know, talking about our recommendations, the discussion piece was an important conversation. It is interesting because as a person that's also involved in social media, I'm very fortunate and I would say very boundaried in terms of, you know, the access that I have. So the discussions, I think, can be important, but it also can have a negative effect depending on who you're talking to. So being very aware of supportive conversations, particularly if individuals, you know, are being negatively affected, is going to be important. Not trying to engage as much in the debates. Does racism exist? Is this a racist, you know, sort of incident that I'm, you know, sort of noticing? And I see people, you know, sometimes get into social media arguments about it. One of my kind of rules of thumbs, you know, at times when I feel more activated, is there's some conversations I'm not going to have. As a professional, I can give you a list of resources and readings, but to engage in sort of debates about the topic can also lead to increased sort of negative experiences. So what I found is that I've identified a very supportive community of individuals that I know are in some ways like-minded. It doesn't mean that we think all of the same things, but that they're able to listen, to respond, and that we're able to have a productive conversation so I can say, this is how I'm feeling. And they can offer recommendations about something that, you know, okay, Miriam, this is maybe what you need to do, you know, at this particular time. You know, so my husband is, you know, we're obviously living in the same house. One of our supporters will say, we need to turn off, you know, the television. We need to be more conscious of things that will allow us to feel better. That doesn't mean that we avoid the issue and that we're not aware of what is going on. So we are just very careful about how much information we're taking in so as not to re-traumatize ourselves, so to speak.
And then you list the importance of seeking support in a variety of ways. What are some of those opportunities for support?
Sure. I would say that, you know, for many people, they start with sort of who's the community around me. And again, differentiate. So make a distinction between those people that are supportive, whether they're family, you know, for example, or friends that are going to be supportive or not. But also it's important to recognize, you know, community resources. So thinking about spiritual communities and leaders. Also, you know, if you engage in practices like yoga and mindfulness, things that are more calming, as a source of support. Also sort of turning, you know, finding groups, for example, that might engage in what we know to be helpful during times of increased stress, like maybe walking with a group of friends, not necessarily focusing on what's going on, but doing something to make yourself kind of physically and mentally feel better. But it really is about, for each individual or community, really identifying those sources of support and places, both within the family, but and families can be tense places, you may have to look outside of family and friends and connect with other individuals. So there are, you know, persons who may organize more formal sort of protests or poetry readings. You know, it really is about connecting to what makes any individual or group of individuals feel better and trying to connect with individuals that are going to offer support.
These days you hear more and more people talking about the importance of self-care, mm-hmm. and I think that's really a new generational topic. Mm-hmm. What would you describe as self-care, especially when it comes to dealing with racial trauma?
Self-care, you know, as a mental health professional, it is also a catchphrase that we often talk about and have to remind ourselves to engage in, because you're, you know, assisting and helping other people. Self-care is a really big one for me, because I can recall, you know, even sort of being as a graduate student, when a few graduate students of color in an environment that was racially tense, sort of asking myself, and I remember my advisor, Dr. Janet Helms, saying to me, what is your armor? And really sort of challenged me to think about, you know, there are many ways in which, given the work that I'm interested in around race and racism, and the environment that I'm in, that in many ways it almost feels as if, you know, there are days where you're going out and, you know, they're like little shots being fired at you. And there, so there are dents that, you know, come into your armor. And so what, Miriam, is going to allow you to get back to a place where you're able to function, to go to work, to exist, to be able to have conversations. So for me, physical activity is a big one. You know, I was awake at 4 o'clock this morning, engaging in physical activity from 5 to 6, you know, o'clock this morning. It really helps me to sort of reduce my stress, to give me, you know, sort of increased clarity, helps my body feel really good. In addition, you know, sort of when I'm thinking about times of increased stress. So physical activity is a big one. So whether that is walking, you know, not everybody needs to wake up at 4. For me, my, you know, an exercise at 5 o'clock in the morning, but I would recommend some physical activity, because just from a basic physiological level, we know that that, you know, assists with the impacts of stress, like hypertension, increased, you know, sort of blood pressure, those types of things.
And then finally, in the article, you're talking about a way to overcome racial trauma is empowerment through resistance.
Absolutely.
What does that mean?
I think sometimes the term resistance has a negative or bad connotation, so to speak, but really talking about just the history of activism and the feelings that many people sometimes have, you know, in situations where they feel marginalized or oppressed, is that there can be feelings of helplessness and hopelessness that, you know, emerge. Racism is a big topic, has a longstanding history. And so sometimes I've often heard people as of late sort of saying, you know, we're still dealing with similar issues, you know, that we were dealing with years ago. Is it going to get better? So I think it's important to take a step back and sort of ask, what are the things? How can we learn from history? So some progress has been made, but how can we learn from history in an effort to feel involved, to feel that we're contributing to progression and to the movement? And that can, you know, be through a variety of ways. So we've seen, you know, sort of local organized movements, for example. Again, movements that may allow people to just express their emotions, you know, sort of freely. For me and for my colleagues, it was writing this article. So being able to contribute to and create awareness around the issue of racial trauma, and to specifically, we made a conscious choice to target communities of color with respect to understanding and providing them with resources to help recover from experiences of racism, discrimination. Because I find that people will use catchphrases like cultural competence, but what is it and what does it look like? And that's really what we were attempting to offer. So the activism piece, or the empowerment through resistance, is the resistance to oppression, the resistance to racism that helps communities feel empowered in a strategic way to address some of these larger societal issues.
Because by working at it, we can make things better. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
30,000 square feet. What would you do with that kind of possibility? Would you strategize your future? Or get lost in the past? Will you fill it with stories? Or use it to empty your mind? Would you explore your spirituality? Or focus on improving your community? Will you use it to work late? Or just work it? Could you create lasting impressions? Or a brief, delicious one? Our vision for the 224? 30,000 square feet of endless possibilities.
Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Miriam Jernigan Noesi, and she's the president and CEO of Jernigan and Associates. And we're talking about now the racism recovery plan. We're talking about the impact of racial trauma. In this article, you also provide us with a wellness toolbox and some other things that people can do to overcome the impact of racial trauma. Talk about that.
Sure. One of the things that was really important to write about was to not just talk about the issue of racial trauma and sort of leave people there, but really to offer some tips and tools for how to address the experiences that individuals are having. And so we went back to kind of the core of ourselves as mental health professionals and as psychologists in an effort to help people sort of begin with sort of thinking about tapping into their own kind of resources and understanding what helps me feel better. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, what are the things that, you know, improve my mood if I'm not having such a good day? And so we really start there, which is asking people to kind of describe what they're like when they're managing or responding to, we say racism in a healthy manner, but if that's too difficult, you know, for people to begin thinking about, but when you're in a negative situation, you know, when you're able to overcome that situation, what are the some of the things that you do to assist
yourself
in feeling better? So, for example,
if you're on the job and somebody says something that's a little bit off, those microaggressions, how do we handle it well would be... What are some of those options?
So I'll actually use myself as a personal example. I, you know, in any given moment, and, you know, it's unfortunate, but it does happen, you know, at work for me at times, I will pause and decide in that moment, because I also see myself as an advocate and I have a certain role, you know, among my team. Is this, depending on how I'm feeling, you know, on any given day, is this a moment where it's actually more helpful for me to not verbally respond? And to not sort of internalize what's going on? Or is this a moment where I feel like it will be helpful for me to become an advocate? And that's, you know, that's a decision. One of the things, regardless of whether I decide in the moment to respond to what has happened and, you know, sort of facilitate awareness, is that I have a wonderful group of supporters that I may touch base with after the fact. So there are people on speed dial that I can call and say, this happened. And they, you know, sort of talk me through the situation, validate my experience, because, you know, in some cases, the system that you're in may not validate that experience. So having a support system to be able to call and reference and sort of talk about what has happened. In the absence of that, I would say, you know, sort of journaling for people, creating space sometimes if I'm at work and after a meeting, if I can take a moment to walk outside, so as not to, again, kind of internalize that experience. I sometimes have, you know, if I'm not able to respond in the moment or don't feel as though I want to respond in the moment, I may send, you know, as a professional, some references and resources and ask to come back to the issue is the idea.
So the power of the pause.
The power of the pause. And then I would say the follow-up is, you know, sort of identifying what's going to help the situation. Is that talking it out? Is it sort of taking a moment to yourself? Is it journaling about it later on, doing something to, you know, really care for yourself? If you need to after the fact.
And so another step that you have there is you're talking about having a response plan as a whole to the triggers. What would that be?
One of the things that we ask people to do, and so think about the recovery, the racism recovery plan as a sort of preventative effort. So I would recommend that people do it. You can certainly attempt to do it in the midst of an event, but it's often helpful to sort of have this. The key is to have it in place. Prior to, and we can't always predict when incidents of racism and discrimination are going to happen, but it's the idea that you have kind of taken an inventory of yourself to be able to sort of schedule out whether it's your day or activities throughout the week that are going to maybe balance out some of the experiences you may have. So, for example, maybe you might engage in meditation or yoga. Are there days of the week that are longer or meetings that might be more tense or, you know, for young people, you know, if they have particularly negative experiences at school, are there ways in which, you know, with your family that you can pause, but in a different way, you know, in a more structured way to be able to engage in activities that are going to allow you really to calm the body in a physiological sense. So you're calming the mind, but also, you know, from a biological sense, we're talking about the sort of parasympathetic nervous system. The ability of the body to return to kind of a normal state of calmness and being content. And for, again, I'll say for each individual, that's going to be different. So I would encourage people to reflect on what works and then to also be open to new things that they have not thought about, you know, previously.
Now, the last two steps, I think, would be powerful for any community. The idea of crisis planning and post-crisis planning. When we look at what's happening around the country, these days, we're just so sensitive, and we know that in any community, there could be another crisis such as what we've seen in other places. So right now in Greater Hartford, how might we as a community do crisis planning? In other words, instead of the individualized planning for how to respond to racism, How do we as a community start to look at crisis planning and then post-crisis planning? What would you say to that for the psychological health of a community?
I really think, you know, one of the big pieces in terms of crisis planning is acknowledging and having the conversations and the larger systems that our communities, you know, may go to. So thinking about, for example, the role of sort of spiritual, religious communities, churches, et cetera. Also thinking about schools and making schools aware that this is an issue. And it may affect, you know, as we talk about in the article, certain students more than others, depending on a variety of factors. And so how can we identify professionals who may be able to assist students or families, but also I think having the conversation and recognizing that this is an important issue for the community and then using those larger systems to be able to identify individuals that can serve as formalized resources. So I know, for example, one of my colleagues who's located in the Maryland area, their particular church has an actual subcommittee of mental health professionals who offer workshops and will actually have addressed workshops on whether it's on a Saturday or asked to make announcements, you know, on Sundays if persons are going to church, to be able to talk about, you know, themselves as resources, but certainly offer a group space to be able to provide outreach for a larger body of individuals. I think same thing for schools, being able to acknowledge that this is happening both at K through 12, but I've also seen this at a lot of higher education institutions. I've gone in and facilitated some workshops where students are saying that they feel further marginalized because their institutions are not acknowledging that this is going on. They haven't put out statements, you know, for example.
Now, if people wanted to have an opportunity to read the article in its entirety, how do they get it?
The easiest way, and that's one of the reasons why we titled the article as we did, but if you Google Racial Trauma is Real, it actually does. It's published online through the Institute for the Study and Promotion of Race and Culture. It is available online in PDF format as well as on the website. So if you remember nothing else, I would say Google Racial Trauma is Real. It is one of the first links that you can click onto. It will provide you access to a PDF that you can download. I encourage people to share it widely with colleagues, to have the discussions, but it's also available online via my website, Jernigan & Associates Psychological and Educational Consulting, but also through the Institute for the Study and Promotion of Race and Culture.
Dr. Miriam Jernigan Noesi, we thank you so much for your service and helping to care for the mental health of all people.
That concludes today's Rich Answers program from the Conference of Churches on Light 100.5 WRCH. If you enjoyed hearing our segments today, you can download them for free on iTunes. Also, be sure to connect with us on the web at conferenceofchurches.org or contact us on Facebook or Twitter to suggest a guest or topic you would like to learn more about. I'm Reverend Dr. Shelley Best from the Conference of Churches. Thank you for listening. God bless you and have a wonderful day.